Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Two Narrows podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined as always by my good friend, Timmy Long.
Hi, everyone.
John Connors, how's the farm?
I'm very good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Great to have you here in Ballymun Access Theatre.
Yeah.
You were telling us a mecca of arts and theatre.
100%. I mean, about 10 years ago, I started like mentoring young artists and rappers and singers and actors. Myself, Damien Dempsey, Maverick Sabre, Terry McMahon and others. And this place blew me away. The amount of working class people coming into one room, creating something specifically to the young men. Mm. And for rap, I mean, if you're looking at one area that's like the most rappers per capita, I'd say it's Ballymun in Ireland. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, just so much creativity comes. And there's an open door in this place. Mm. Mark O'Brien, the former creative director, and now Niamh, they're just brilliant. You know what I mean? Whatever anybody wants, you know what I mean? Just walk in, there's an open door. It's brilliant, and Ballymun needed this, you know?
Why do you think it's such a creative space?
I think one by having people like that, like, I mean, Mark O'Brien, who's, again, he's now went on to be in the Abbey, literally the reach out stuff, you know what I mean? Like, really reaching out to the community and not just trying to tick boxes and get funding. Really making an actual effort, actually caring. That makes someone at the top actually caring. And Niamh now, who's taken over now, is the same. They're there for the right fucking reasons. They're not a tyrannical leader who's just trying to tick boxes and get funding. Yeah. So that's the difference, I think. And then you open the door to a state-of-the-art place like this and all the technology they have and everything, it's the best.
Anytime we're looking for a space to come up here, the door is always open.
And reasonable prices and everything like that, like, you know what I mean?
If even a price.
Exactly. Well, same with me. You get me a load of freebies with things like that, what I wanted to do, if it was something that is good and nutritional for the community. You know what I mean?
You'll always kind of return the favour.
Yeah.
But listen, John, this is our second time around.
Yeah.
The first time we done it below in the studio in Cork, and, you know, and we were chatting about it beforehand, and it was one of the most powerful podcasts we had, and this will probably outdo it here.
Yeah.
Had technical issues on the night.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, I remember it. Like, I told my friend Teddy there was the best podcast I ever did. And if it was an average podcast, I probably would have walked by rage and gone, fuck the lads, even though it wasn't your fault.
Yeah.
But because it was so great of a conversation, I felt great driving the waves need that day.
Anyway, like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I knew we'd do it again. You know what I mean? So and here we are in Ballymun near my hood. Like.
Yeah, sure. We were delighted to have you on because, you know, when you're commenting on our stuff and sharing our stuff, it doesn't go unnoticed. You know what I mean? So we were delighted to have you on. So it's great to be here.
Mm.
But we're going to bring it right back. Just tell us, you said you're not far from here. Where are you from? What was it like growing up for yourself?
I'm from, well, I was born in London.
Yeah.
And this is obviously stuff we went through before. I'll act like we haven't. but I was born in London. And the reason why I was born in London, a fact that my brothers will never let me forget, is because my father, who was a schizophrenic, he hijacked a taxi one day and he went straight into the wall and broke his hip and he got put on arm guard in the hospital. And my mother had been engaged to him for like 2-3 years at that time. Big long engagements for travellers, about to get married. And she visited him in hospital and decided to escape him out the window. And they went on a ferry to England. And met up with my mother's sister, and she was married to Purcell over there, and all the family. And he met up with his McCarthy cousins and that. And so they went over there, and they were there for a couple of years. And then I came along, and I was born in King's Cross in London. And before it was one, I came back. But that's the mad thing. That was one of the things that shaped me. Like, we can joke about it, but I always felt less than Irish. It was a weird one because my two brothers were born in Dublin, and we had like
dislike about it.
Oh, you sure, lads, I won the Four Nations gold medal for Ireland, beat an Englishman in the final who said he was going to knock me out. You paddy cunt, right? And I showed the lads, and I broke his ribs. And I showed the lads the tape of it, my two brothers, and he says, "You should have been fighting for Britain, you bastards." So, like, you never win with the cunts. But I'm glad it happened because it shaped me and shaped my whole worldview. And it made me really interested in Irish history and Irish culture. And I became fucking more Irish than them in that way, you know what I mean? And I wasn't alone because I had like 52 first cousins that grew up in the camp when we came back to Coolock. So 52 first cousins, then probably 20, 30 second cousins in 12 aunts and uncles, grandparents, friends of the family, all in like basically a reservation. Yeah. And so about like 20 of us at least were born in England. And we'd be the English bastards.
But you know what today? Ye 20 have English passports today. And no, they're invaluable.
I couldn't do it, man.
But they're there anyway if you ever went to them.
Yeah, they're there if you need. They're good for certain kinds of things. It's the worst passport in general in the world to have because they're an imperialistic bastards. And not the people, but just the elites.
Yeah.
Like all the other European elites. But for certain, getting into certain countries as well and the Commonwealth and all that stuff. But no, I'd never get away. I couldn't live it up, lads, if I got a British passport.
But what was it like, do you know, going back to the days when you can actually remember growing up inside the site with the lads and the cousins and stuff? How was it with your mum and dad and everything else?
It was fucking brilliant, to be honest with you. I'm over the moon that I had that. I was that last generation. Do you know what I mean? Before social media, before everything. Yeah. And for, you know, lots of things changing for travellers. But I had a father who was a great father. Like, he was schizophrenic, but he was like kind of eccentric and like unbelievably smart. His nickname was the professor. And in ways, he was kind of an outsider among the traveller men because he just thought outside the box about everything, you know? And he had me, like I met me play school teacher, Miss Moore. And she called me over, I hadn't seen her in like 30 years. And I was like, man, like 25 years, whatever it is. And she said, come over. I was telling my husband about you. You and your brother Joe, you were so freaky because you could read before you could walk. Because my father taught us how to read before we could fucking walk. Literally, we were reading newspapers. So like it was like mad. He was like mad like that, and he'd always teach things like, you know, always ask questions, never just take something
critical thing.
Yeah, always think outside the box and go, why are you saying that? You know, and always stand up for what you believe in. Always, you can fight to the death for that. So that them kind of things, like it's mad. Those sort of echoes never left me, all like throughout my life. And sometimes I took it really literal, and sometimes more symbolically.
Get you in trouble, but
I did. It got me in trouble as well. Like even the never back down from the fight.
Yeah.
That was a hard one, especially when you grow up where I grew up, and you're in the middle of Darndale and Coolock, and you're surrounded by traveller sites one side, Darndale the other side. And you have to fight the whole way to school.
Tough area, John.
But you have to be tough.
Yes. You have to be tough
to be able 100%. To
win. You have to be. It's as simple as you grew up in a similar area, yeah. But for us, we had a kind of unique thing in that because it's an awful truth, but it's the truth. When you grow up without a father as a traveller, there's an extra edge to that. You're seen as victims to other travellers. And like, because everything is about who's the father and could I get away with doing something if he's this or that or the other. But if you have no father, it's free reign to do what you want.
There's no comeback.
So me and my brother Joe got a lot of bullying, like from kids our own age, but older, that was the ones you'd be more worried about. And then the emotional stuff and the kind of the belittling and denigrating. Like, so we would have been looked at by some of the older men in the camp of like, oh, I'd never let my daughter marry one of them. And you'd hear things like that because you don't know how to make a living. They'll never be real men, like, because they've no father. So that stuff was worse than getting the shit kicked out of you.
That's when you were younger.
Yeah, so like at 8, like my father tried to commit suicide. Look, I can't get that word out, commit. I was still saying it. Like it's a crime, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a church thing.
It's a weird thing, and I still, every time I say it without thinking, that's the way it comes out. But
it's a sin in the eyes of the church.
And it's a crime. Commit, you know what I mean?
Do you know, growing up, for me, even the word suicide, you know the way adults talk about suicide, and this is years ago now, and I don't know, can you relate or not? But, you know, people would always say suicide was the easy way out, the cowardly way out. You know, people didn't understand it back then. They didn't. You know, my own mother took her own life. My mother's partner took her own life. I've plenty of family members. But because of my own mental health years later and the stuff that I went through and the thoughts of taking my own life and coming close a few times and you know, I understand. No, like it's not about anything else. It's just it's pain that human beings are not made to be able to take. You know, and that's why people. It's not a way out. It's just people just break they get to a place and they just can't take it. No.
It's a threshold. It's not. They reach a threshold.
Years ago, we used to call it different things or whatever, you know, but it's not like that at all. It's just it's something that just happens and nobody will know why it happens, but it just happens and there's no real answer to it. It's just, it's pain.
It's pain, yeah.
And that's it.
I think people who say that are silly because it takes some fucking balls to kill yourself. Balls like fucking gorilla balls to kill yourself, because I came close a few times and I backed out.
Yeah.
One, being afraid. Two, me mother. What would happen to me mother? Like, if I, you know, I listened to me mother cry for years through the wall in the trailer after my father died through suicide. And imagine me doing that, where like she's dead basically straight away. Mm-hmm. If I do that, me brothers, what it made me out, brothers, yeah. The closest brothers in the world. My father tried it a lot of times. I caught him one time, and then he went into a mental hospital. Like we used to go and visit him in the mental hospital.
Yeah.
And we thought it was a dojo, and he was learning martial arts, and everybody went along with us. You know what I mean? So we'd go in and we'd sign out, and I never forget, we did this mad journey. We'd get the bus from Coolock into town, then we get the train from town out to Balbriggan, and we'd walk from Balbriggan, Dunabate, then we'd walk from Dunabate down to Port Rann, and then we go into the mental hospital, and we were going to meet my daddy, who's like nearly gets his black belt now. Mm. And this is like for years, like, you know, he never got the fucking black belt. But the staff would go along with him, he'd play along, fair play to him, you know what I mean? We didn't know it was the time, like, obviously, you know, but we're walking down, and I remember one day we walked down, and the staff was bringing us down, and my mommy's there, and we get excited. He was in, because it was still had the bars, you know, the bars they had in the cells,
yeah.
And the padded cell with bars.
Yeah.
That's what he was in. Oh. But he was in all this white clothing, so it was like a craddy. Yeah, you know what I mean? So, but he'd know we're coming, so he'd be there in like a yoga position like that, nice clothes, right? Oh, and then he'd go, John and Joe, and we go, how do you know? You know, this is, you know, how do you know it's us? And then he'd jump, bah, bah, and do all the moves. And then we go out the back and play out the back leg. So we were arguing, when are you getting your black belt? And then I remember there was an old Chinese fiend in there, and he just bowed to the Chinese fiend like he's
the Miyagi.
Yeah, like he's the fucking sensei. And we were like, there's a sensei, there's a Miyagi guy. We'd be weak, like, but we'd understand why he has to stay there to get the belt.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So but then him and mommy would have that tug of war, and obviously like, you know, she knew, you know, it's very taxing on her and us. And then he'd go back and he'd be grand for a while, and then but then he just turned like he'd just turn into a different human being. Like, he thought he was different people. Like, I remember there was an IRA man by the name of Dominic McClinchy. Do you remember him? Yeah. IRA man up the north, blew loads of people up. He thought he was him. Like, and he'd do, all right, lads, come over here, yeah. And all, and another day he'd be Terminator. Like, literally, he'd be like, think he was Terminator.
What was it? Split personality disorder?
Yeah, I think there was multiple. I don't think he was fully diagnosed. One, that was schizophrenia. And no. Oftentimes there's multiple. You know what I mean? Because they're closely related. It's like you're going to one to the other.
Yeah.
So he would do a lot of that, and we'd be like, he'd be funny sometimes, and sometimes it'd be very, very fucking scary, like, and my mother would be terrified, you know. So he ended up going back out of the mental hospital after I found him trying to overdose with pills. And then we moved back into the camp finally. We left the flat. Mommy said, we have to bring it back to my people into the camp. And so one day I was out in the backfield and I heard him call me, and he said, John, come here to me, son. And I was going, Daddy, where are you? And this went on for about 10 minutes. And I went into my mother and I said, Mommy, I said, Daddy's out in the backfield. And she's like, no, he's not in the mental hospital. You know what I mean? What she didn't know was he actually escaped out of it, got out of it, or one way or another. And an hour later, the guards came in, and we were in their dinner, and the guards came in and told us that he was found in a lake, drowned. The lake of his secondary school that he went to, that he used to bring us to play in the woods. So he kind of threw himself in the river. He couldn't swim. So that kind of, that's the big change in my life when that happened.
That left you vulnerable then?
Yeah, it left us vulnerable to kind of people who just, yeah, look down upon us and all that. So, but it make us tough, but like, it made me repress so much. Yeah. And I hated him then, like, I hated him. Like, once we started getting bullied, I hated him. And I loved my father more than anything, like. But I went, fuck him, like, he left us, like, and
you had to blame someone for your pain.
I had to blame somebody, and looking at my mother and going, she has to do it all alone, like, it's not fair, like, and my mother I love, there's no one I love more in the world than my mother, times 10, no one else compared to her, like, but what she went through, so it was rough, and we had a few years, and I was getting bullied left and centre, like black eyes every day, to and from school, and then fighting set of lads in school, and then getting segregated, putting in all traveller class, even though me and my brother Joe were academically very bright, until we told my mother about it then, and she went over and kicked the fuss up, and we went back into the general population.
There used to be an all traveller class in the primary school, then.
Yeah, there was. Yeah. There was an all traveller class, and then there was another class that you had just all the fellas that were messers or just couldn't sit in a normal class. A lot of them fellas later on would have came out like they would have had something wrong with them, ADHD, dyslexia, but it wasn't diagnosed back then. But you had a traveller class, you had a messer's class, and you had your three or four normal classes then.
Yeah. Well, we used to, we went into the class the first time, I'll never forget the teacher, Mr. Holbein. He gives us crayons. And I said, crayons? Well, what are we doing with crayons? Like, I mean, Joe was reading newspapers at 2 years of age, 3 years of age. Like, he gives a crayon. I said, can we get another book we can read or one? He said, oh, you can read. It, like, it reminds me of that scene in Life. Do you ever see Life at Martin Lawrence and Eddie Murphy? But he go in and get the pie. And he says, hey, Roger, could I get some of that pie? How do you know my name? You can read? You know, this level of ignorance. And he gave us Huggy Bear. And I said, Mr. Holbein, I was reading this in second class. See, because what was common practice was you'd do second class with, you'd stay up there with the general population up in the second class, you do your communion, and then the third, then they'd put you in an all travel class. This is the pattern I've seen all around Ireland. Like, so he was like shocked, oh, you can read on. We were reading, and he was like, oh, really good. Look, read whatever you want over there, blah, blah, blah. And it was like no guidance and a free for all. Like, and it was just, you know what it was, lads? It was so embarrassing because we had all our friends like in our class, like other kids and whatever. And yeah, we got called a pikey or knacker by one or two of them, but most of them, like, still to this day are my friends. Yeah. Like, we went to school from 4 years of age together, and we're still friends to this day from Darndale, like Coolock and Brysard and Clonshock. So when we all of a sudden got put in that class, me and Joe, we were fucking so ashamed, like. And the lads were going, why are you all together there? Because, like, you're putting them in travellers of all ages, from just 36 of all ages, generally put in there. So I got fucking very angry with that.
Mike Quilligan,
North West.
Talks a lot. This is still going on, like.
Yeah, well,
varying degrees.
I know it's still going on now, even with, they're
reduced
trying to
timetables.
Yeah, reduce timetables and all. It's another way of doing it. But even travellers were still properly segregated 2 years ago in some places in Wicklow, I heard. It didn't stop. Like, and I'm only 33, lads. Like, I'm not talking about Alabama in the 50s and I'm being black. Like, I'm a traveller who grew up in the 90s.
Exactly.
You know, right up to the early 2000s. So
we had a podcast there last year with Patrick McCann. Do you know Patrick?
Yeah, I do know Patrick, actually. Yeah, Patrick's from Finglas.
Yeah, he came over from Manchester, two different sides, Dunsink Glen, Coolock, I think.
Yeah, he would have been, yeah.
He said that it was lucky he was able to fight, because he was able to protect himself and his family because he was into the boxing. Did you go into the boxing? Did that help you kind of stand up? And
so normally, like, you know, the mad thing about travellers, it's one of the great things is the boxing culture, because, like, Ireland has been consistently in the top 10 boxing countries in the world for the last 20 years. Every other country in the world has at least that's in that top 10 has at least 10 times our population. So that proves the fighting Irish thing. Now, travellers make up 0.6% of the population of Ireland, and they make up sometimes up to 50% of the champions. So that's like fucking mad. And that's the culture. But the thing is, the culture is getting driven by the men and the fathers. But I didn't have a father, so I didn't get put in boxing. Do you know what I mean? But I was looking around when you were all going into boxing, and I'm getting the head punched off me every day. And I went, I have to go to boxing. I think I actually remember watching Rocky one time. And I said, that's it. That's Rocky. You know what I mean? Me and my brother Joe watch Rocky every single day. Rocky 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Every day. We watched Rocky 3. We watched it so many times. We said, we'll start counting how many times we watched this. So we watched it every day for a year. Rocky 3.
Yeah.
Just put it on every day, you know? But so I went to the boxing club. And I said, fucking, I went with two of my old friends. I grew up with old Patrick Gavin and Terence Gavin, I think it was. And we went up and they told us, Joe Russell, who was a real old school Sheriff Street inner city. Remember Mickey from Rocky?
Yeah.
On steroids. And like PC, anti-PC, oh my God. But he said when we walked in, this is your fourth night and your last night. You can get your jackets and fuck off out of here. And I said, okay, geez, this is intimidating, right? So we went for the jog, and I'm kind of a half chubby fella at the time and trying my old best to keep up a jog, but I'm putting a lot of effort in. I go back to the club and I'm hitting the pads. And he's seen something in me, and he said, you can come back Wednesday. So I went back and we hadn't, it's mad because success breeds success.
Yeah.
Darren Dill had a great history of boxing, but he hadn't won an All-Ireland title in probably 5 years. So I went into it and within 6 months I won the league title, the Dublin title, the Leinster title, the All-Ireland title. Okay. Within 6 months. And then we start getting all-Ireland champions. And like the amount of travellers in that club, like we ended up being the best club in Dublin for 10 years in a row. Leinster 7 years in a row. Three times best club in Ireland. And I was a part of that. And
so how did you stay there for?
I did, yeah. Well,
you come across as a really intelligent man, John, as well. And I think boxing is not just about all brawn. Boxing is a lot of intelligence.
Big time. Boxing is problem solving.
Yeah. Like my small lad, Jay, since the last time we were chatting, he joined boxing and he's a smart kid. And I see how fast he's after taking up the boxing. Oh, he was in an All-Ireland there for a few months ago. He got robbed.
So I just, it happens though.
He got robbed.
Happened to me.
But anyhow, we won't be bad about it. I seen that he was a smart kid, but he also had, he had it about him, like, and he was good, you know, yeah. And he's doing really well.
Yeah.
Did you know, were you listening to your coach? Were you smart about the boxing? Did you pick?
Yeah, absolutely. But I was also my own worst enemy too, because I had so much rage in me. Like the best performance I ever gave in the ring was actually a show fight. Wasn't even an important fight. And I did All-Irelands one day, all that, Four Nations. The best was one day I was fighting a fella and he was two weight categories ahead of me in a show fight in Crumlin. And he was also a four-time Irish boxing champion. And my trainer Joe said to me, Joe Lawler, one of my trainers, he was an Olympian. He said, John, you know, just for the crack, will you do me a favour, please? I said, what, Joe? He said, for the first time ever, will you just use your brain in the fight, you know, because I just wanted to go forward and aggressive. Now, I had a good jab that saved me from getting sloppy. He said, just use your brain. He said, you know what, go on the back foot and fight him on the back foot. And I gave your man that bad of a beating that they called the first round after a minute, the second round after 40 seconds, and the third round after 30 seconds, because it was crumbling. They were cheating bastards, because I would have stopped the cunt. But I gave him an absolute, and me friend, this is a brag to say, but my old friend Fraggle, and my cousin, he said, Johnny, you're like Sugar Ray Robinson. Because you've never seen that side of me, you know, but I showed it in time that I'm in sparring.
Yeah.
And I was like, Jesus, I should have done my whole fucking career like that. Yeah. And then I ended up having the big fight against a Shade I fought, who was from Wicklow, and it was in the semi-final of the Intermediate All-Ireland. I was like one of the youngest people in the whole competition. I'm 17, so it's the youngest you can be to get into it, but most 17 year olds don't go in it unless they're cleaning up in the underage. And I looked across the ring and I saw the size of the vein, right? And it was 91 kilos, but I was only weighing in 88 kilos, you know what I mean? And he would have been coming from probably 100, and he was 30 years of age. I said, I'm done with this fella, right? So I just used the jab and I only threw one right hand in the whole fight, and I bet him 19-1 just with jabbing. Yeah. And the very last punch I hit him was a right hand. I never even threw the right hand. So I've had to listen more, you know, that kind of way. But
it's a great sport.
It's a great fucking sport. It's great for children, you know. Like my trainers, to me, they're fucking humanitarians. Like they never got paid for doing this. Like all boxing trainers and amateur clubs, they're saving kids from the streets. Like I couldn't even estimate how many children he saved. Joe Russell, Joe Lawler, Jerry Hanlon in Darndale as well, in the middle of the heroin. He started that in 1975 and he's still doing it. He's still the trainer. Never got a penny his whole life.
Yeah.
And Joe Lawler and Jerry Hanlon.
They're terribly underfunded as well, the boxing clubs.
Yeah. They're not funded at all.
Yeah.
They don't get funding.
Yeah.
At all, my club, Darndale. I'd still call it my club because it'll always be for me, like, because it was a place where you could find catharsis. Do you know what I mean? Like, and they were coaches in life and they would teach you things and they stopped me from going down. Like I got in some mad shit in my teens in Darndale, and I ain't gonna lie about it, and violence and lots of mad stuff, and my skills that I had was seen as a strength on the street, put it that way, by people, you know. But it would have went way worse only for them, because they were constantly pulling me back into the ring. Do you know what I mean? Like, and they were like, it'd save your life, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, your boxing is a great sport. So John, just go back a small bit, right, say maybe from your early teens, what were things at this stage in your life? You know, your dad was dead, you were doing a bit of boxing. How were you getting on?
Once I found boxing, I got confidence because I had really low self-esteem. So I started getting really fucking confident, like, and I lost a lot of weight and I got in really good shape, and I didn't realise I was a fucking natural athlete. So I was just I won fucking all those titles in boxing. I won things in football. I won 5 gold medals in one there, 1 year in athletics, all different 5 gold medals and a silver, which pissed me off because I was that fucking aggressive of a competitor. Like, so just once I hit 12, I kind of went, you know, puberty just treated me well. It was like fucking big doses of testosterone, I'd say. But I had an unquenchable appetite for winning, like obsessively. And I got unbelievably disciplined, like. And like, we had a camp gym. We built a camp gym. Well, actually, I won't say we built it. The lads built it while I was boxing in the Four Nations, my cousins and my brothers. And they built it for all of us. And we'd be up at 2 o'clock in the morning. We just decide, well, let's do a 3-hour training session in the camp gym. Put on fucking the Rocky soundtrack.
Yeah.
Like, we genuinely do that. Like, you'd go, right, let's do a jog. Let's see how fucking fast we can do 5K.
Yeah.
I think we did it in 15 minutes one time or something like that. Like 15, 16 minutes. We were just lunatics. Then you go to boxing. 6 days a week we were training in the boxing club. We're training outside of it. So it was just obsessive, like obsessive. And 16, I'd say, was about the age where that obsession started to stop. And women and, you know, I discovered women before that, but in 16 I was hitting my peak. Yeah. I don't think I've ever went back there. But then you're starting to drink and you're hanging around Darndale and you're going to Swords to this Bure and you're over there and you're eating kebabs, and but you're getting away with it because you're 16.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But then when you hit fucking 18, it's different. Yeah. And then I went into a fight. Oh, fuck me. It nearly killed me. Fought my last fight, and first of all, that intermediate I was telling you about, I went to the final of that, and I fought another fellow, Willie Byrne, who was like 27 or 8 at the time, and he beat me in the final by only a couple of points, and I had a bad flu going into it as well, very bad flu, and my trainer wanted to pull me out of it. I said never. Went into that, and then I went next year doing the under-19s, and a fiend bent me that should have never bent me, and that's what disgusts me. But I trained just for 6 weeks after not training for about 6 months at tennis elbow, and thought I'm just going to steamroll him.
Yeah.
And it's when my confidence went to arrogance, total arrogance, and I walked in as a red hot favourite, like. And I went in the semi-final and knocked a fella out in probably 20 seconds, like rendered him unconscious, and I said I'm going to do the same to this fiend, and he went in and he boxed the brains out of me.
Buster Douglas moment, didn't it?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. He boxed the brains out of me. And he went in thinking he was going to lose because we fought in the Irish team together.
Yeah.
And I was used to kill him in sparring. Like, he couldn't even spar me. And he went in and I got what I deserved, which was a nice little nasty boxing lesson. And I just was reaching and going, what the fuck? My time and everything was gone. Yeah. And then I went, right, I'm going to get back to it now. I'm going to do it normal, blah, blah, blah. And I got involved in street stuff. And then bare knuckle fighting, you know, that's gotten away and breaking hands off that and doing all that shit. I don't regret that, to be honest with you, because the fellas at Bet were the bullies. Do you know what I mean? The fellas that bullied me as a child, basically.
Did any of those bare knuckle fights get out of hand where they weren't just left the way it's supposed to be?
Funny enough, they all resolved the issue, but they were big things beforehand. Not all of them, but the first one, we were feuding for years. Like, lads, I was in a feud at 13 years of age. You know, I was told, I'm not going to say by who, but I was told to go in and grab, you know, someone hid a shotgun in my mother's trailer. I was told to go in and get it. And I was 13, and we were surrounded by ERU, the emergency response unit, the whole side was. And I went in to get it, and they told me there was no bullets in the gun. And I was a big John Wayne fan. I love John Wayne and Clint Eastwood and all, like, obsessively, like. So I was like,
how? You see the movie in Winsley?
Yeah, yeah. So I was holding the gun, and I was inside the trailer. I grabbed the gun in the back room, and I put the gun up against the wall like that, you know. And I was just prepping, and I went, ah, sure, there's no bullets, right? And I went, bang! Big hole in the trailer. Shades came down. Shades were terrified. Me mommy and all my aunts came running, ah, me child, ah. And they managed to convince the shades that it was the other family we were feuding with that shot over the wall and blew the whole trailer. But it was like a hole, like, because I shot it up close with a big shotgun. And I went over to my grandmother in Darndale, old Margarita McCarthy, married Connors, obviously. She was real soft. Come in, son, come in, hugging me and kissing me. And I said, over there for about a week, it was ready in my life. But then I was back into the feud, like, back into...
January 13, that stage.
13, yeah, I was back into the feud, back into, like, going toe-to-toe fiends out in the streets. 14, at 14, I was going toe-to-toe with, like, adults in the street and bait them.
Yeah.
And weapons, like monkey wrenches, you know.
You're not involved in that. Are you walking around confident with a swagger, or are you walking around full of fear looking over your shoulder?
Walking around terrified, acting confident.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrified.
Yeah, perfect answer there.
Absolutely terrified. Like, and it's same with the ring. Like, when I used to be in the dressing room to go in to find the ring, right? The lads all in the club used to say, Jesus, like, Tono, you're as cold as ice, you get no nerves. And it was only because my training was the bullying. They concealed the fear. I was acting.
Yeah.
That was my first acting. I acted like I was fearless. Mm. I was a brilliant actor, but I was terrified. And when I was in them dressing rooms about to go out in the fight spots, I was saying to myself, what are you doing to yourself? Why are you putting yourself through the stress? You're going to be killed now in front of everybody. Like, you're going to be made a show of, like, what? Just quit boxing. Every time I fought, I was telling myself, you need to quit boxing. It's too stressful, like. Yeah. And it was even worse out in the street because it could go way worse.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, bad things happened, like, you know what I mean? So, and then all those fellas, it ended up getting really fucking nasty and we had to move, like. And then we moved up to another area. And then this family found me in the, I was walking down Darndale Road one time and I was 13, June 2003. And they chased after me in a van and they all jumped out, but I was so fast by that point. Like, I was the same height I am now at 13, but so fucking fast. And I ran like fucking Forrest Gump, boys. And I ran back to the camp, right? But when I got back to the camp, my face was all drooped. I got fucking Bell's palsy, do you know, from the fright. Yeah, got Bell's palsy from the fright. I ended up getting that twice more in my life. One more for another stressful incident as well in my late teens and then later on for something else. But so there was all that. There was a lot of, I saw a lot of violence. A lot of violence. I was involved in a lot of violence. I got a nice few beds myself.
You break the cycle of violence?
Fuck me, man. I don't know if I'm breaking it yet, to be honest.
Because it's time, don't it?
Yeah, because... And
do you know what? That law was be within you as well to react in the appropriate way if you're being maybe challenged.
Yeah, let's say exactly. That.
So if someone comes up to you with a fucking hatchet or whatever, like, you're not going to lie down on the floor and start crying.
No.
You know,
well, because
you have it already.
There's a certain moral code I'll always carry anyway. Yeah. I'll always have. And that comes from the bullying. That comes from no one's going to denigrate me. And there's certain things that I will just access the psychopath in me and go, I'm willing to die in this moment. I'm willing to die if I have to. And that's if you harm anybody belonging to me. And you notice this pattern with anybody who's been harmed or been bullied. When you touch people they love, they're even more enraged because it's like, hang on, I took enough. You won't be doing nothing to anybody belonging to me. And like, it was even when my nephew was there last night and this morning teaching them boxing. And they're catching on really good, like they're deadly, you know. And even the thought of someone bullying, because I'm looking at them and they're, I remember me and my brother Joe was that age and the bullying we were getting, like, if someone bullied them, boys.
Yeah. Because you're bringing
Hannibal Lecter.
But yeah. You're bringing yourself back through your own pain and you don't want them to feel that.
And I'm going, and look at how beautiful they are now, how pure they are, how vulnerable they are. You know, especially one of them, like, he's real quiet, like real introverted, and the other fellow's real extroverted, you know. And I'm going, God help us, lads, if someone tried to put hands on him, like, poor child, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You think how many fucking maniacs there's out there, boys?
Do you know that kind of stuff there that went down as a child? A lot of fear in that stuff, John.
Oh,
you
know,
you carry that. How do you deal with that stuff today? Do you understand it?
Oh, I totally. I've analysed myself inside and out, and I have the benefit of having fucking one of the most qualified mental health experts in Ireland as we fucking want to be best friends, like. Yeah. So I've analysed a lot of that, and I know how I react to things and where it comes from. And that's why I have an internal dialogue all the time and how I communicate to people. And don't be projecting onto people. And don't be just going, that's what they meant, you know, that overthinking, that kind of metacognition. I kind of have to stop myself all the time. And the fear never goes away, boys, you know. And the fear, and it's like, it manifested in other shit on, like, you know, with me controversies online and whatever. And it's a very nuanced conversation to have, but people would never understand it. But, like, you know, at times where I did stupid things myself, but people come after me and it's like, I can't back down. Mm. I can't back down. Like, I feel like I'm getting bullied again.
Yeah.
And I'd rather die than get bullied or face it, because it's like this, the fear in itself is fucking crippling. Mm. So I have to face the fear straight on, because it's so fucking crippling, because it's like, that's the worst place to be in the corner, just going, oh, the whole world. So then I go, just attack. The best offense, the best defense is a good offense.
And you're allowing yourself not to be a victim anymore.
Like, yeah.
You're not going to leave these people.
That's it. I'll refuse to be a victim. And my thing's even like I've said, you know, me and my cousins and all that, and we've evolved in mad shit and whatever. bearing of fights and even like, but even just brawls, like brawls, you know, like I did a brawl one time at a wedding and a cousin of mine was getting attacked by these fellas who were bowel fiends and whatever. We grabbed them, we were outnumbered, it was only me and my cousin and my brother, Joe. And so we grabbed them and just brought them out to the front. But then they came out and there was like 20 of them and there was no running. And my cousin fainted on the ground because he was weak as water after being pulled and dragged. And I just turned to the boys and said, we just have to stand now, that's it. Yeah. And I said, whatever happens, happens. That's it. You have to just use the psychotic part. So I went over to one of them and got him a nice lucky punch and knocked him out straight away. And then I had 5, 6, 7 fellas on me at one time. They did it to me, the other two, my brother and my cousin as well, and both of them got put in the ground and smashed up. But my brother Joe gave a really good go, especially like, but they couldn't take me down. Do you remember Jake Lamotte? He can't take me down, right? Like, I just refused to go down. I said, boys, there's nothing is going to get me down. And they're roaring at me and they're Budweiser bottles in my head and all this stuff. And they wouldn't get me down. And I when I mean I put power, I mean, I would ever punch from the ground.
Mm.
That's the shots I was giving these veins. And I was like, I was hurting. Like, 2 or 3 of them went on the ambulance, very badly hurt. Just the rage that comes over you and you can't feel pain.
Mm.
It's like the whole thing.
Black.
You
black.
Can't. You can't feel pain. And then back in the hotel room later on that night, oh, wig is water.
Do you know?
Black eyes, everything. Keep in head, but somebody give me an aspirin, lads.
Do you know, for people that are listening to this,
yeah,
they wouldn't understand what we're, even, do you know, they wouldn't understand it. You really have to grow up in a really tough environment to be able to understand that when enough of bad things happen to you, you hit a spot in life where you have to make a decision for yourself that it's never going to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And from that moment on, nobody will ever hurt you in that physical or mental way again. And that's what happens. It's built. Remember we were saying that's built into you?
Yeah.
You can be aware about it, but it's always there. And you said it, if someone harmed one of your family in the morning, like that's there, and it's there to protect them. And it's just to kind of give it into a little bit of context to people that don't understand it. It's not that I am a bad person, you're a bad person, or anybody else that wants to. It's just in the areas we grew up in, that's how we had to mind ourselves. We were never bad people. It was just things happened and we had to do these things to be able to survive in the communities that we grew up in.
Well, it's a sad, mad and bad thing.
That's it.
There's very rarely a bad person. No. They're usually sad or they're mad.
Or they're hurt. Even.
You know what I mean? And that was me. And it still is me. And that's why that code will never be broken. You harm anybody belonging to me, I'm willing to do life in jail. Outside of that, I can keep it calm. I mediate, I go from family to family and stop them arguing. I do that now today. Me and my brothers do that. We're kind of the go-to where we're from.
Does that work, John? Maybe in mediation between...
So, like, we've often had it even with groups of cousins, right, who are both fucking the same to us, you know? So what would happen is my brother Joe would go to one of them and it's just, you have to go and listen to all the stuff.
Mm.
You have to... never report any of the bad stuff.
Mm.
You have to play a blinder, basically. And you have to kind of hint that the other side one piece, but you can't say it out direct because it'll become a slagging thing. Yeah. And then I go to the other and I'm doing the same thing. And they're telling you, I want to kill them and I'm going to, and they're getting this and I'm getting a shot and I got it all. And I'm going, 100%. But listen, I know you don't want the trouble. Like, boys, and listen, we let it go. I'm like, I'm never letting it go. And you know you have to do that for the whole day.
Mm.
The whole day. Because there's always one hothead in the family. And then oftentimes even you get the deal and then one hand out and then they go into it. And that happened before, actually, when I was doing a mediating between two different groups, me and my brother, Joe. And we had the deal finally after about 7-8 hours of going back and forth. And we're sick of our bollocks at this time. Like, and then the two blackguards on each side roared at each other. So I said, right, get the fuck in that car now. And the two of them are cowards. I said, get the fuck in that car now. I said, you're going to fight now. As a year to one starting all this. So we got them in the car and the two of them went at each other. The worst boxers I've ever seen in my life. But it was a great fight because they didn't know how to fight. So when one would hit, the other one would go to the ground. I was like, this is a great fight. And the referee with me, the fair play man, said to me, he said, John, listen, call a draw now, because the first thing you do is ask for a draw, because the best way is always a draw.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, no, there's no draws. I said, these have to punch each other's faces in and then I'll ask for a draw. Do you know what I mean? So I let them at it for about 6-7 minutes. Now, 6-7 minutes when you're not a boxer and there's 4 swinging knockdowns swinging from helicopters and windmills, right? Then I went in when they're awake as well. Then I went in. I said, boys, Hey, you like a draw? Yeah, straight away they tell them. We stab your blackguard.
They were gassed over the desk there.
Yeah, just that was it.
Yeah, I seen you tagged on the Twitter a good few years ago now at this stage, I'd say. There was a feud. It could have been one in north side of Cork or it could have been somewhere else. And this guy tagged you and it says, John, you should get John in. They won't listen to settled people. And your response was funny.
Wow.
And he says, I tell you what, he says, seeing as you're a settled man, why don't you go in the media between the Kinahans and the Hutches all together? It's just because I'm a traveller, I'm supposed to go in and fix that. Why don't you fix that?
And John is not better to do either, by the way. Like, John hasn't got his own old career going. Or, you know what I mean? Like, it's ghastly. I remember one thing. You do get fucking. Actually, I'm going to tell a story. My friend Teddy's there. Their boys is a funny one, right? So this famous stalking me on Facebook. Big fan, love hate fan, Carver Gangs fan, and all that. And he's stalking me. And I try to be nice to fans always, like, genuinely. Unless
we are trolling,
he's stalking me in a good way. Like, he was a bit, just a bit weird, though.
Yeah.
But, like, unless a fiend is an ignorant to me, I'll give them all the time. And anybody. There was one fiend actually one time said to me, rugby top he was wearing, so that'll tell you where he's from.
Yeah.
I'm getting a selfie with you. And I said, sorry, you want to remember that, Ted? And Lily's. Lily Bordello's, I'm getting a selfie with you. I said, you're getting it. You mean you want a selfie? No, I'm getting a selfie with you.
Entitled, like.
I said, I'll tell you what you're getting. I said, I'm going to take your shoulder from your chest if you don't go out that door now. Oh my God. So that's the kind of thing, that's the only thing I turned down a selfie in my whole life.
Yeah,
but the stalker fiend, right? He's on to me. He's a big fan. My son's a big fan, all this blah, blah. I said, oh, nice one, mate. Yeah, blah. I'd love to meet you. Like, I'd love to. Come on, like, I can't meet every fucking fan that I've got there. I said, where do you live? I said, nah, none of that. Could you send me your address? Remember, Daddy? Right? So I said, listen, I'm drawing a line up to this. You're not getting me address, right? I'm not going to fucking meet you. Unless I happen to fucking meet you, right? And me and Teddy is in my house in Darren.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Arndale, right? My mother's house in Arndale. And we're on the couches together. And we're just smoking rollies, drinking tea, saying this thing is gas, right? So anyway, the next night then, I just signs into my messenger. And there's 1,000,001 texts of him, right? He obviously had to get him gargled and got a bit of pluck and start getting bowled, you know? And it was just slate me, right? And the funniest one ever, remember I said, the funniest one ever, he said, John, if it wasn't for Love Hedge, you'd still be fighting in car parks. I said to Teddy, read that. I swear. But what happened then was, I got back to him and I said, 100%, right? So then he went, no, that wasn't me. You know, he got afraid then, like, or he was sorry, because obviously he was drunk, like. So you meet randomers like that.
You have to laugh at insults.
I love laughing against that.
Twitter last time, I was laughing, but there was a picture of Timmy and there was an inspirational quote, you know, and it was like, well done, love the tonaries, then your man counted the two gormies. That's like sometimes says, well,
yeah.
The two gormies.
Boys, but Twitter is a hell of a lot, so I don't expect anything positive to happen on Twitter.
I know. Yeah. Instagram is a different story.
It is. It's different and it's negative in another way because it's kind of more narcissistic, whereas Twitter's sure negative. But I mean, I just drop in and out of it, so it suits me.
Are you on Twitter now?
No, I like that Roderick O'Gorman whole fiasco. I said Twitter will never see me ever again. Ever again. I got out of it and I'm never going to go back on Twitter. It'll never ever see me again. I'm happy enough on Instagram.
Yeah, but the office is more
and that's a good decision.
It's a bit of a crack. It's a bit of crack at it as well. Like, in the gas, it's gas boys because he said go me fiend yours and all that. You know that's traveller language.
I know that.
Isn't that mad? The way Cork and Limerick does that. I find that fascinating.
We grew up with that
time. I know. Yeah. But you to me would be like travellers.
The Spring Lane is in Blackpool.
I know Spring Lane,
there's loads. And then there's travellers living in houses all over. So the language just gets into
it. Gas, isn't it?
People say, like, oh, that's Limerick slang, Cork slang. It's not Cork slang at all. It's actually traveller. Gammon.
Exactly.
That's integrated
into our language, it's gas. You know? But, like, when I go down to places like Cork and Limerick and you like working class places in Cork and Limerick, I couldn't tell the difference between the traveller and the settled person. I can't. Because, you know, like, people don't even understand there's so many different branches of travellers. Like every family is different. Yeah. Every family has a different accent.
But the gas, there's some settled people then trying to be travellers.
That's a big thing now. That's the big thing. But where I'm from, like in Coolock, there was sort of the wards, which is basically my people, my mother's people. And you have McDonough's, you have Collins's, you have Mongan's, Motton's, you have Purcell's, Joyce's. Everybody's a different accent, like. Every family is a different accent within a mile radius of each other. People wouldn't understand that, like. It's mad, like.
It's gas,
like the Collins would be where I grew up, and I grew up with Collins would be almost, they actually would be far out related, like all travellers are, incest is the best sex and all that, but they would be very close to me. We grew up in the boxing clubs together, lovely people, but their accent would be very different than mine, and we live next door to each other.
Do you ever visit TVG in Cork? Traveller Visibility Group.
No.
Traveller Project in Blackpool.
I could have. I've done a lot of things like that down in Cork. I never remember an organisation to be.
Big family, organisation.
You have a family up in the wild, and there's these three or four women, and there's all the clans in the north side. Yeah. All the clans in Cork City are from these two or three women, you know?
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. McCarthy's.
Jesus. The McCarthy's, But I have more McCarthy in me than anything else because my grandmother was McCarthy both sides.
Yeah.
And then my grandfather, her husband, was half McCarthy. Yeah. So, and like, yeah, more McCarthy than anything else.
Do you know when you're growing up in Downdale, what's the relationship between the settled community and the travelling community?
Say I grew up in Coolock. If for some reason it was worse in Belcamp, which is right next to Darndale, which is in Coolock, was good as well, like, you know. But in Darndale, very little discrimination, if I'm being honest. Yeah. Very little. Because you have to remember the most little it can be, basically, you know. And you have to remember, they're stigmatized themselves. And they're like, Coolock is stigmatized. Now, Darndale is an area, is a council say within Coolock that Coolock people don't even want to be associated with.
It's different levels.
It's like the worst address you could probably have in Dublin is Darndale. The worst to get a job. It is that, isn't it? Like, so the Darndale aliens, that's what the Darndalian aliens, that's what they're called. You know what I mean? That's what I am, one of them myself. Like, so I'm a Darndale traveller, never had a shot. But, we fucking, Darndale had such a great community. And like, my boxing trainer lived in Darndale. That's where he lived as well. Like, he was a community leader. And we just got along grand. Like, I'll settle friends and, you know, of course, all the bureaus are settled in Darndale and, you know, which was handy. we have very little discrimination in Darndale.
You're stigmatised because, and discriminated against because of your address. Mm. You're putting in a CV for applications. Mm. So Darndale. But then coming from the site within Darndale is another added discrimination.
Absolutely.
But you know, when you're growing up, do you feel like that your prospects in life, they're not there for you?
Oh, yeah. So listen, I don't even know how. Like, I know how it all happened for me. Not that I'm at a Hollywood or anything like that, but where I am, like, it's a bad thing to say. Like, my mother would have encouraged us so much, but I know she would have been happy enough that we just grow up, we're not criminals and we're not addicted to drugs. Yeah. Like, that is amazing. That's, you know what I'm saying to you? Yeah. But she'd encourage anything beyond that and would believe in you.
Yeah, that's a bonus. Like,
So like, I'm looking now and go, like, I still go, what's going on? Like, well, how did life get me here? How am I making films? How am I? Like,
how did film start? Yeah. How did it all come together?
Yeah. I did an acting class. Just serendipity, boys, to be honest. Like, there's a plan out there for all of us. And I think if you tune into that frequency, you'll see the plan. That's basically it. And my brother Joe, when I decided to kill myself, my brother Joe knocked on my door and said, are you going to kill yourself? What's that? And I says, no, but I gave him an indication I was. because I didn't want to say it, but I wanted to talk about it because I was desperate, because I was in pain and all that. And he said to me, please don't, because we can't afford to bury you.
Was he serious, John?
He was serious as well and joking. Oh, yeah. Because the shame of not being able to bury my old brother, that's actually a serious thing. But he masqueraded it into a nice joke. And he said, look, man, you need to do something. You need to find something else. Like you.
What age were you, John?
I was 20.
I wondered, did he have any training around suicide awareness? No. That's the right question.
The number one question to ask them.
Are you going
to
do it? Have you a plan?
Yeah, because it erupts in front of you one way or another. You'll find out. You can gauge from their body language at minimum, which is what he did. My brother Joe has just been always very, very intelligent and in tune.
He's a character as well.
Just me two brothers, to be honest with you, we were all genetically blessed.
Yeah.
And me mother says it's me, now to be daddy, like she'd always say, well, none of my business, they got the brains in their daddy. And and also, lads, when you grow up around danger, you're always looking for danger.
Yeah.
Your senses get very sharp. It's problem solving, isn't it? You see a problem, you're trying to fix it, and you don't even know you're trying to do it as a kid. But later in life, they become your sharp fucking tools. Yeah. And now we can see them coming a mile away now. But he said that to me, and then he said, look, Jono, you know, boxing didn't work out. You didn't want to go back, blah, blah, blah. You're at the game, all this weight. Why don't you try acting? Now, he didn't just say that and pull that out of his arse. It's because I was obsessed with films since a child. And the previous 2 years, I just spent watching films after I gave up what I was doing, the nasty stuff. And all I did was only left the house to go to collect my doll, buy DVDs, or go to the cinema. That was it. So he said, why don't you try acting? And I just saw a life jacket. That was it. And I said, yeah. And rang up an acting class, and the bureau said to me on the other end of the phone, Kathleen Warner Yates, great acting teacher, mentor as well, from America. She said, why don't you try acting for fun? This course we have. And I knew that's wrong for me. I said, I need something more intense. She said, there's a scene study course, and you're going to be out of your depth in it, really. So maybe that's not the best. I said, I'll do that. And I said, how much is it? €290. They get €100 out of me doll. Got the rest of my brother Joe from his doll. And and then my mother, I got £5 for the bus in and out of town. And I went into the class and was intimidated straight away. And decided to leave the class, but an improvisation happened, and I was just kind of curious watching it unfold. And this Brazilian man, this black Brazilian man, was in a scene with an upper class Dublin fella, and the upper class Dublin fella dictated the scene. And that's the way it was set up. So he became the customer who was going in to buy off the shopkeeper, and it could be any kind of variation of that.
Yeah.
So he went in and he decided it was a health food store, and he was looking for vanilla protein and whatever, you know. And but he ended up being really patronising towards a Brazilian man. And I thought it was racist, to be honest. He was making a laugh of his kind of accent and language. And so I just felt a bit of solidarity with the Brazilian man, and I got enraged, and depression and anger is like Sammy Swin. So I volunteered, because the Dublin fella then became the shopkeeper and they were looking for a new customer to dictate the scene. So I walked out of the class, and it's gone because I'm getting nervous now, because I remember being so nervous. But what happened was I knew I could belt now, and they'd never get me, and I'd walk away and I'd be really comfortable. But I was so fucking angry that I busted through that door, and I basically imagined there was a bank. And I went in and robbed the bank and robbed him, and I slapped the face off him, and I took the shirts off him and his shoes and socks, and the teacher ran in and roared John, stop, please stop. The living Jesus. So I ran out of class, and she ran after me and I ran the whole way down Abbey Street, and she was please come back. I said, please don't ring the shades. And she was please stop, John, stop. And I went, okay. I said, what is it? She said, don't ever fucking do that again. And I said, okay. Said, but I liked that. That was good. I said, oh shit.
There's potential there. Yeah.
He said, let's see what else you can do. You can do raids I've never seen. Let's see if you can do the other stuff. So she gave me a vulnerable character to play about 10 weeks later on a thing. But I had the lines learned from it 12 hours later by not to go. I never slept. And I just learned the lines for this 10 minute scene, which normally take you 2 weeks to learn. I learned it. I just learned it over and over the whole night. Googling on the internet and all the tips and all the shit. And come back the next week, knew me lines inside out, most prepared man in the class. And then I was like, okay, here's a new obsession. And then the universe took over then, because I mean, my goal was, I was like 20 that time. I said, if I got an old short film to act in by the time I was 25 or something, you know, that'd be great. Like, within 6 months, I got the lead in a feature film.
What was the name of that again?
King of the Travellers.
King of the Travellers. I've seen that, John.
So my childhood buddy, John Collins, who's still a good friend of mine, and all his family, love all that family, he was the lead in the film originally. And then I rehearsed for it and got a bit of a small part. And then I was rehearsing for months because we were all like kind of non-actors. So we were rehearsing for months like a play. Like, and they ended up sacking him. And he turned around and said, you better be giving it to John Connors. And he went, yeah, actually we are. So fair play to old John. And he gave it to me. And I was like the lead role in a fucking million-euro budget film. I was like, mad. Yeah. Just mad. Like, you're going, what the fuck? And I had no right being the lead in it, to be honest. Like, looking back in that, like, I learned a lot, but it's like, I couldn't watch that film. Like,
what's the Travellers at White House? Was it, what's the Travellers?
Morehouse. Yeah. The Morehouses and the Powerses. And listen, it ended up causing a bit of feud between the Morehouses and the Powerses in Wicklow or something. They ended up killing each other. You dirty bastard, you Morehouse, you bastard. Of course, I got life imitating art and art imitating life and all that. And then I was on set with that, and me and Mark O'Connor, the director, that talked about, I was talking about a play I was writing about my father and about schizophrenia and mental health. And then he knew a fellow who was a stalker and blah, blah, blah. A fellow who was a kind of a cinema buff stalker that he knew in Ranelagh, in a place in Dublin. And we combined both stories and made a film called The Stalker, which did brilliant critically. And actually went to the same festival that year as King of the Travellers and won an award ahead of King of the Travellers. And it was only a 15 grand budget compared to a mess. You know, it's kind of a mad, crazy film. And then Love, Hate. And
that was, so you got a huge, you got a big role in, you know, something that was like an Irish cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
Love, Hate.
Yeah.
How did it come about? What was it like being cast into that? Like that fame.
Well, it's weird because I did Love, Hate before King of the Travellers ended them, because the casting director came to Darren Box with him and said, we're looking for tough looking fellas to be extras. And Jerry, my trainer, actually said, oh, John is John's doing acting, he does the old classes and all that. John, come over here. And I said, nah, I'm no interest in being an extra. Like, they said, well, look, there's a couple of special extra roles and there's a few lines. Can't guarantee them, but if you show up in the day, fight for them. You know what I mean? I said, okay, no problem. So I showed up, and it was the pipe bombing thing where Nids is buying a pipe bomb off me, but I didn't know if I was getting that character or whatever. I was going to be standing around. But it was me and this fella, I never forget, a fella, red-haired fella from Kilmore in Dublin, two of us together. And Caffo, the director of Love, Hate, who's now went on to be a huge director, he came over to stand up. Well, lads, how are you doing? How are you doing? What's up? What? Tell me. And I was like, ah, blah, blah, born in London. London, yeah, I've lived in London 20 years and blah, blah, blah. And I said, whereabouts? Oh, the Caledonia Road. I said, I lived there. He said, there was a pub there. I said, yeah, my father used to drink there. Oh, I used to drink with Travellers there. I probably drank with your father. What year? I said, 89, 90, all that. Yeah. And I was like, connecting. He said, do you want these lines? And I went straight away, yeah, I want these lines. But what I didn't know was, I didn't really know the efficacy around it all and the way you behave. Because I looked at the lines and I went, yeah, they're not. And I don't want to, because the writer and me are good friends. But these particular lines didn't work for me.
You needed your own.
Yeah. Words. I said, look, I'm from the hood. I'm from the Irondale Traveller. I know this world inside out. He's not going to say that. And the director said, oh, well, what would he say then? I said, blah, 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 blah. And whatever I said, whatever it is, put a pop on or whatever, that was part of it. What happened was, I did the scene with Nidge, and I did King of the Traveller and Stalker then. And after the premiere of one of them in Galway, Stuart Carlin, the writer, come up to me. And he said, John, I'm the writer of Love, Hate. And I went, yeah. He said, you know, he said, you improvise some lines on the set. He said, playing that pipe bomb character, the special extra character. I said, yeah. He said, you haunted my dreams, you bastard. Yeah, he said, because the improv is so good. And I went, okay. He said, would you like to come back? Let's find a way of making it back. Now, it appears so obvious now. Obviously, I gave the bomb to Nades that blew up Linda's house in France. But like, when the plot is not there, you don't know. So he didn't know what way to bring me back. And then he just decided, okay.
You created the role around you, saw it.
Yeah. Created all around me for season 4, and it was in 3 episodes, and I was fucking over the moon. Over the moon. And then in season 5, my character left, went to England, and then I met him, and he just said, look, John, your character's no real hinterland or whatever. We just showed your character. Do you want to come back? And if so, do you want to do a small or big? I said, what do you fucking think? All the way, is it? So he worked with me for about 6 weeks, and me and him just became really good friends, but sound cunt, and did his due diligence. and did it right. And then the result is some of the best writing I was ever confronted with, you know.
What was it like becoming so famous? Did you have to, was it a big adjustment? Sorry, not think about it too much? Or?
No, it was weird. Weird. Like, you have to understand as well, man, like, I grew up getting a lot of hate and then a lot of fucking discrimination. And then all of a sudden all these guns are over and they're wanting this and that. And you go, and then I'm like, I have the chip on my shoulder. Who you, fuck you, where are you coming with?
Where are you
then? You know what I mean? Like, and then you're still cheating my people like this, but you come over to me and it's all right because I'm a famous traveller. And it was all that shite. Which was me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I should have just went, smile. Have a smile and a Coke and shut the fuck up. Yeah. You know what I mean? But you don't know that. You have to learn it yourself. Yeah. And if someone tells you that, it doesn't work anyway. Yeah. You have to go through the process. But the weird one was, I went to the UB40 concert. I love UB40.
Yeah, me too.
And went to them in the Olympia. And goes to the side entrance. And there's a security guard there. Was an old boxer man of mine, Michael Parker. Great boxer, southpaw. And he said, Sean, oh, what's up, man? And the night before, I think it was, or the week before, the episode with me saying, take it back with you and use it to buy yourself a headstone. When it became one of the first kind of memes in Irish social media and it went viral, you know. And so I didn't really realise, because I was only walking around my own area for a week, Darndale, and he says, ah, Jono, whatever. So I was in the town for the first time then, since then. And he said, Jono, bad idea. He clocked us right away. He said, don't walk through there. Like, I said, what? What are you talking about? He says, you're going to be a mob, man. I said, quay, man, I'm going to be fucking mad. What are you talking about? About 500 people. About 500 people between him and the door. And I got mobbed. And when I'm in mobbed, right, I got harassed. And my T-shirt was ripped off me.
Oh, God.
Women ripping my T-shirt off, scraping me like it was a fucking beetle. And to say to me, I'm no oil painting. Like, women, now, and this one's not even a joke, lads. This is getting dark. Yeah. Women grabbed me by the balls.
Fuck off.
Sexually assaulted me, man.
And you loved it.
Yeah, maybe I did. Well, I like some of them, maybe. But so anyway, the security have to come out. And the security have to get all around me to bring me to my seat. So they bring me to the seat, but then I get mobbed in my seat. Yeah. And he said, oh, Jesus, you're a distraction. So then we have to give you a VIP. Brought me down to VIP. I got mobbed in VIP, but that was right in front of the trades. And Ali Campbell literally was going like that. To get... do something with me because I was because it was right in front of the stage of the VIP. So the performers on the stage were fucking distracted. So they had to put me into a boot. And I was like, what the fuck is this? It was crazy and not good at all. Not good at all.
How did you feel, John?
Oh, overwhelmed, man. Yeah. Overwhelmed, like. Now, then that night I went straight to a nightclub and I got straight in the door, which was a refreshing feeling. Because every nightclub I probably got refused from every nightclub I've ever went to before that in town. Yeah. Like, I remember my uncle, ironically named Brother, who's one of my best old friends as well, and the funniest man you ever met in your life.
Your uncle, his name is
Brother. Yeah, won't even get into it, but his name is Brother. But it's because he was the first brother to come along in the family, like 20-year line.
Oh, you know?
So, yeah. So me and him went, and we counted, we went to 35 pubs and clubs and got turned down by all of them in one night. Like, this is before I was famous. And then 2-3 months later, then I can get into any nightclub in town.
Yeah.
And then you're going, I'm annoyed by that as well, like.
Yeah.
But then they give you the VIP and the free fucking champers. Yeah. And then you're like,
have that status and that fame.
It's terrible, isn't it? But everything is status. Like, if you think back in fucking caveman times, it was all status. Women didn't want the little weakling in the corner, the little beta male who was collecting leaves. Yeah. They wanted the fucking Adonis over there who was killing animals.
I know.
It's all status. Yeah. You know what I mean? But I do hate when people treat people different over status.
Mm.
That, I think, is fucking horrible. You know, I think that's horrible, like, to do it. Now, it happens in between genders in a different way. But I mean, when people do that in general, like, they give this fella the time of day because he has X, Y, and Z, but not this. And I see it a lot with travellers along with money and that, you know what I mean? I think it's a horrible, denigrating thing to do to people, like. I think just treat people fucking as they fucking come, like, you know what I mean? It's the only way.
Yeah, and that doesn't matter whether they're sitting in the street.
Yep.
Inside in a hospital. You know, up inside in the prison or whatever it may be, if you treat people with respect,
yeah,
it changes their perception of the reality of life.
I was only over in Richmond in England, which is in London, which is like the poshest part of London, Richmond. It's beside Twickenham. And I was in a hotel that was like £1,000 a night overlooking the Thames. I didn't pay for it. It was a company I was working for and doing a big TV show for Netflix. Can't say what it is though, but a big gangster show. For Netflix Global. And I was down and I was having an old fag on the bench overlooking the Thames, a lovely old view. And an old fiend came down and he was mildly drunk and rough fiend now, a rough looking old fiend. And when he was walking down, he was like Moses parting the fucking sea. All the people were just running for this thing. And when he came just even near the benches, they all ran off the benches. And I just seen it happening, like, in real time. And I just felt overwhelmingly fucking emotional for this thing. You know, go, imagine everywhere you go, people are just running away from you, like, like he's a pariah. And he said to me, "All right, mate, have you got a smoke?" And I went, 100%. I said, "Sit down there." And I gave him fucking a packet of fags. I had three packets of fags. I gave him a packet of fags and I gave him a lighter. And I said, "Tell me your story, man." "Oh, actually, my grandfather was Irish and he was in the IRA and all." And I said, "No way, man. Are you serious?" And we're going up the rash yet and whatever, you know. "These fucking cunts, they don't fucking know." You know what I mean? He's playing me as well, but I get it. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then he says, "Yeah, you know what I mean." But he offers me a Suffy's wine. I said, "Nah, I won't bother, man. I won't have him." But I had about an hour long conversation. I had the best crack at him of all time, like.
Yeah.
And I gave him an old tenner and all his way. And there's just a lovely fucking interaction.
Isn't it lovely?
There was totally humanity, and he got into his trauma. I wouldn't even go into all that stuff, but he had a terrible old trauma, like.
You,
what's happening in your life to lead you to
that? Man, sure, he's just the result of all his experiences. That's all it fucking is.
And you know what? The result of them experiences are just still down here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's where the...
And he repressed it all. Still, he can't express it.
No.
So he's expressing it through... He's expressing it through fucking... through self-destructive behaviour.
Yeah.
That's fucking what it is. I've done it myself a million fucking times. Press that button. It's about time now. Yeah. Like, I do it every 10 years. Every 10 years I do the self-destruction thing, probably.
But do you think this... Do you know all those people that were sitting on those benches that ran away from him? Do you think if he was able to stand up in front of all those people and give his story of where he came from, that they'd have that little bit of compassion and empathy for him, and they'd probably sit
there? But it does the bridge of how he gets there, as in, are they going to sit to listen?
It is about the bridge.
I think most people would, because most people are not psychopaths.
No. And that's what we're doing here.
This is what this platform is about.
That's what it's about.
This is what it is.
It's about getting those stories out there.
And this is why I love this platform, and I think you two are some of the most important people in this space, lads, genuinely. And you're the most unique for this kind of platform. And what I love about you bringing this thing all around, bringing it back around to what we're saying, ye don't go for status. Your guests are not about status at all. That is your fucking selling point, is that you're fucking authentic. And see, authenticity is one thing I've learned in life. If you're fucking authentic, shit happens for you. If you can remain authentic and keep your fucking morals and live by your code, good things fucking happen. Authenticity breeds. We can smell it off people. And that's why you've been successful at.
Yeah.
You're totally authentic.
Yeah, but I think it helps that we've no media background or training or anything like that.
So that would ruin it.
Yeah.
You'd have these like bullet point questions and all.
Yeah, it'd be fucking sleeping.
Well, prompted over there.
I'd say, please kill me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But instead, you're able to tease things out of people, lads, and you feel comfortable. And I've watched a lot of your episodes, right? And I just know, right, because I've went through it all myself, and I've went through things like being a support worker even for 5 years, and did lots of workshops, whatever. And I know how fucking smart you are, and how you can sit back, listen, be relaxed, create an atmosphere. You don't jump on the guest. You leave things relaxed, and then people open up. And it's why you've blown up.
Yeah.
It's because people open up. And then we get a look into their soul.
Yeah.
And that's fucking gold. And it's because you're so fucking emotionally mature. Mm. You've went to hell and back. And you come out the fucking other side. Like, that's fucking beautiful, lads.
You lose your ego when you're doing that. Like.
But that's interesting, actually, because we haven't wanted true addiction and everything and into recovery and whatever. This coming along, and you're stars now, lads, and especially in Cork, has the ego sneaked up a bit, though?
No, even when somebody says something like that, I feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that's my stuff.
Yeah.
Do you know, it's just that I still go to work, and I work with my hands.
Yeah.
Do you know, I go home at the end of the day, I do whatever my wife needs me to do.
Yeah.
I do the podcast, I fucking do my invoices, I answer my emails, I do our talks we have to do. I don't look as myself being any different to who I was before, any better.
When did you set this up? 2-3 years ago?
3 years tomorrow,
June,
this month.
2020.
June 20. And how long are both of you in recovery?
I'm 12 years.
12 years.
It'll be 10 years next month.
12 years. 10 years. So what if 9 years ago could you have done this?
Absolutely not.
Why?
Because I wasn't.
It takes a lot of personal development and self-acceptance to stand in camera and not try to be something that you aren't. stop accepting yourself. You don't have to try and be tough at the end. You don't have to try and be this.
Yeah.
You are who you are. Accept yourself. Just, and you know, when you get to that space, then you can be authentic and you can leave yourself vulnerable. And so what if you get emotional? So what if you're afraid sometimes? Everybody else is, they just mask it. But you just have a little bit of self-acceptance. 2 years of therapy, that's ongoing as well. We never got a certificate to say, go on about your business, you're recovered. It's an ongoing thing. And you know, we've had difficult times, myself and Timmy, in the last 3 years, personal lives and stuff like that. But like, this is a passion. And it's not like, fuck's sake, I have to do a podcast. It's like, yes, who's the podcast? What's the topic? What's the guest? Then when we go into the prisons and stuff like that, and we met a fella, I give this story, we met a fella in Weefield there last month. And he was in the basement in Mountjoy, and he was self-harming. He was after, I won't give too much details, but he was badly self-harming in a bad way. And he's linked in with a lot of services, right? And nothing was working for him. And he started to play the podcast at Mountjoy. And in the padded cell, he started watching it. And he identified with me, Timmy, and some of the stories of the guests. And things started, you know, he started to identify and see, like, fucking maybe I'm not fucking mad. Look, I can identify with him. And he's doing, I know he's in another prison out of the basement. He's not self-harming. He's engaged with psychology, going to the school. And when we met him, he was so thankful for the podcast.
Jesus.
It gave him a little bit of hope that turned him around, you know what I mean? So, like,
that's real evidence of doing good, man.
We don't give a shit about rewards or money or, you know, ratings or anything like that. That's real people's lives that's been helped by conversations like this.
Do you know this table, these few mics here, a few cameras, this is why I do it. I do it for no other reason. I often say to him, like, I just want to be doing the podcast. That's it. I love doing the podcast. We have to do other stuff to be able to keep everything, keep
corporate
going.
Yeah, stuff like that.
Of course. And it's good. Like, listen, it's good to be able to give back as well and do whatever you can. But it's just what I get from this on a personal level, to be sitting across here now and you opening your soul to me and the other few guests that we had here today. It's the most powerful thing for someone to give you that bit of trust and to be able to share their experience with you.
Yeah.
You can't get it anywhere else. Yeah. And I can see here straight away sitting across from whoever's here, and it never happens, and I'm going to be very honest. We never have a guest here that's here for the wrong reasons.
No.
Never.
Everybody's vetted.
Never.
No. Yeah, of course.
If it's not, they're not genuine and authentic, people are just going to say, the boys have to sell
them. Because, exactly.
Because when you feel it, you see it, you're lost. I can't, because I can't feel it then. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful to be able to listen to someone's story. Listening to your story there, John, like the emotion, and I can relate to a lot of stuff. And sometimes when I'm kind of emotional, I stay a bit quiet.
Yeah.
Because I know it's the way I am.
You're affected by it.
Yeah.
You have to feel it, like.
Because I understand. I understand your upbringing.
Of course, totally. Kind of similar background,
a traveller.
Yeah, but
I come from a background.
But as I said, I can't tell the difference between you anyway. The gloomy fiend and all the door. I go, what? It's not
like,
a wedding.
It's an amazing thing to be a part of. Like, it's absolutely amazing.
The last time we spoke, you had a funny Mountjoy story.
Oh, yeah. Which one did I tell, actually? It was about the fiend.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us that? I do, So I go in and visit the prisons, and first of all, he's asked me to go in and do chats and all that. That's boring the shit out of people. But I went in to do a chat one day, and I felt the room, and I felt they were all interested in acting so much, like they wanted to actually act. And I just went to the bureau, the psychotherapist. I said, like, can I just do a fucking workshop with them? Like, and she says, yeah, go on ahead. So I got them all around, and my old mate Clinchy, who died last year, May, right?
Yeah, May, rest in peace.
He's 1 year anniversary now this month. He was an old legend. But anyway, he was in the room when we were doing the workshop, and he's a great actor. And I said it in his funeral, Clinchy never acted a day in his life. He was totally authentic. You know what I mean? Like, he didn't act. But he was there, and he was giving me the sus of the room and whatever, and start doing things, and I put him in a scene with another fan who I didn't know who he was, and I was slagging everybody in the room because they were all expecting me to be a wimp. I was coming slagging because I knew they'd like the crack.
Yeah.
But whenever I slagged this fiend, there was no laughs. But I slagged everybody else to laugh, and I had them eating out of the palm of my hand because I'm performing. You know what I mean? Slag him, no laughs. I was a bit call you on who's this fiend, lads. So anyway, he did a scene with Clinchy, and he's a better actor than Clinchy in the fucking scene, right? I said, come here to me, Ulysses. Me real cheeky with this fiend, right? He said, "Where to meet you?" I said, "Who are you in the name of God?" I said, "Do you ever act before?" "No, not technically, but kinda." And I went, "Okay, I'm getting the hints now." "Right, grand." Psychotherapist gives me a nod. I said, "All right, no bother." Ends the class, ends the yoke, lets the man away. Psychotherapist comes over to me, "Do you know what that is?" So anyway, I goes back in the screen because I met at my business. I got on them and said, "I want to screen carbic anxious in Mount Shy Prison. That's what I want to do with." It's like the Johnny Cash thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, I wanted to do that and give the lads fucking something and have a chat with all the boys. You know what I mean? And they all know the world. And also a little bit of me wants a little stamp of approval as well. Like, you know what I mean? Like, because the lads fucking know. And I come up in the world, but they know more than me.
Yeah.
So I sit down in the front row and your man, the same fella, comes in. And he says, "Right, lads, shut the fuck up now when this film's on, right? This film is the most authentic portrayal of Dublin gangland culture ever. I saw it already on the telly. It's fucking amazing. All right, so shut up and don't be slagging, blah, blah, blah." And he sat down beside me. "All right, John." Right, we were like best friends at this stage, right? I said, "All right." And he was, I tell you how, he had like an acute awareness because he knew something was wrong with me. I don't know if I told you the rest of this, but... So that morning, my brother had been put on fucking remand and he was arguing with fiends that were in there, they were bowel fiends, and I was going, with the next phone call, is my brother going to be cut up or something? You know what I mean? That could be anxiety, but I couldn't cancel on the fucking boys either, you know? He said, "You all right?" I said, "Yeah, no, I'm all right. Yeah, yeah, yeah." "Yeah, not all right." He was just like a fucking psychologist this way, right? I said, "Ah, well," I said, me brother, he's had to get put on remand in Wheatfield. "Oh, yeah? You worried?" I said, "Yeah, I am a bit, to be honest. I am a bit worried, yeah." I said, "Because X, Y, and Z." "All right, don't need to worry about that. That's grand." I said, "What do you mean?" "That's grand. I'll be worried with somebody over there. And he comes over here, look after them." I said, "All right, nice one." So the film goes on and the screening's going amazing. Now, I screened that film all across the world, all different continents, right? The scene where I punched through the wall, which was a scene that was improvised. It just happened in a moment. It was my real house. Every time that's on, it's pure silence, right? The audience always got dead quiet, dead quiet. When it went on in the prison, they busted out laughing. One or two busted out laughing and it brought the rest of them to laugh. And I went, "But the living house, that's a strange..."
Yeah.
"That's a strange fucking reaction to that, like." And then I talked to the psychotherapist afterwards. So I said... "So don't that reaction," I said, "blah, blah, blah, this never happened. Like, why did I get that reaction, like?" And she said, "Well, there's at least 10 murderers in the audience. And that scene was about me being guilty over the murder. And it caused the tension that made them laugh. And then created a kind of ricochet." Exactly. So I found that fucking interesting. Very interesting, yeah. But that was Mount Joy, like. Yeah. But let me just go back to even, I don't know how far we are here, I don't know.
Yeah.
Just
one minute, 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah, I just want to pick up on what you said. That's perfect. Acceptance, man.
Yeah.
Like accepting yourself. Yeah. Fuck me, it's hard. But when you do it, you're free.
You will.
Mm-hmm. And forgiving yourself. Mm. That's the thing that I found very hard in life. And I know I'm not a bad person, but still find it hard to forgive myself. Mm. I think I'm getting there now, or getting to near there.
Can I give you a small bit of advice?
Yeah.
Forgiveness.
Yeah.
You know, forgiveness is not something that you can be telling yourself, "I'm going to forgive myself tomorrow," or "I'm going to forgive myself," because you feel like you're hurting yourself all the time and you think it's time to forgive yourself. Forgiveness is about when something comes up that you've done and you feel the need that you have to forgive yourself over. It's not about... saying, "I'm going to forgive myself here." It's about feeling whatever that thing is that you need to forgive about, right? And every morning, it's about forgiving that person that something done something to you. It's about forgiving yourself for the stuff that you're beating yourself up. You do it on a daily basis, but you don't say, "I'm going to forgive myself."
No.
You allow yourself to feel whatever it is you need to feel around the forgiveness. And you accept, you said it there, accept, you can accept yourself then. You need to firstly be able to leave it up and then accept it.
Mm.
And acceptance isn't another word that we use. "I'm going to accept it." It's about sitting still and just saying, "This is how it is. I can't change my situation. There's nothing can be done. This is how it is." And feel whatever's going on for you. Whatever thoughts are going on in your head, it's about accepting everything. Accepting the dog barking out the back, the rain pouring down and you want it to be sunny.
you have no control over what goes on in your head unless you have, you want to tell yourself, I'm going to be a multimillionaire, and keep saying that through affirmations. But if there's negative thinking going on in your head and you're feeling a lot of shame, I can tell you this, there's no one standing over you with a puppeteer telling you, giving you shit or putting all this bad stuff. This is stuff that's going on for you. It's there to be felt. It's there to be understood. And you know the fighter that's in you, John? When that fighter knows what fights to pick, okay? See, all that stuff, it won't be an issue anymore because you'll accept it. And for men, for us to accept stuff, we have to allow ourselves to be vulnerable. And for that stuff, for you to forgive, you have to allow yourself to be vulnerable. I have to allow me to be vulnerable. We all do. And it's one of the toughest things for men like us that grow up in areas where there's a lot of violence. Allow yourself to be vulnerable. And if you allow yourself to be vulnerable, you think you're going to be attacked or someone's going to hurt you. And you can't look weak.
Yeah.
But it's the only way to freedom, vulnerability, acceptance. And forgiveness it frees your soul.
Totally.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, next.
No, that's good advice, man. I'm going to take that with me, Timmy. Oh, thank you. You're so fucking right.
It's how it happens for me.
Yeah.
I used to whip myself to death, John. Yeah. I had the worst negative critical mind you could imagine. Like, I used to call myself some names. I was this, that, the other. You know, I felt awful. I had no self-esteem, no confidence. I felt like I was a bad human being. And one day I just said, you know, I can't do nothing about it. And I sat there and I felt that pain in here. And this head up here that was calling me all these names, you're this, you're that, and the other. Every form of thought. And I just sat through it and I felt it, you know. And in time I started to use that as my tool to be able to accept myself. And there was never a word around acceptance is the word, but it's the action of just being still and just being. You know, no matter, no judgment on you or anything else going on in your life. Just be, just feel, just be, allow everything be as it is. And that's where you'll grow. And the vulnerability will come then. Because you'll catch yourself in situations where you would have been fought or not just people in your head. And you'll say, you know, I'll put myself back here and I'm just going to feel it. I can sit in here around the chair, I can feel it on my hamstrings. I can feel my feet in the floor. I can feel my back vibrating. And I'm accepting it. You know, I feel, you know, because I'm in the spotlight here, I feel a little bit, you know, I'm in the spot and I just feel it. And everything that's coming out of my mouth, it's not recorded. It's not pre-wrote or anything like that. It's stuff that's coming out of my mouth because it's through my own lived experience. And that's where the freedom for me came. It's through a lot of work. It's an understanding. You're a very smart person, like, intelligent, like, emotionally intelligent. Don't accept yourself. Not because you need to, because you should be.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, you should be. Nobody should be judging themselves.
Yeah.
No, fuck up.
Exactly. Totally.
Feel it, and I can feel the hunger.
Yeah.
We'll
I'm starving to hunger as well. Do you know what Travis says? Starving to Corollias. Do you know that? Did you know that word, Corollias?
I
never heard of it.
You never heard of Corollias, no? Wake with the Corollias.
Do you ever hear eating the babies?
No.
Yeah, like a bagel, starving.
Yeah.
No, like endless pain. Yeah. That's what my word. Yeah. And I don't know, I said, is that like a traveller version of diabetes you're talking about?
Or do you know Gal Yun?
Yeah, Gal Yun, yeah.
That's the story of the knock, dude. Do you know the different words?
Yeah,
I would have been wrong.
We'll wrap it up before we go on again. Yeah. John, been a pleasure.
Lads, thanks very much. That was special. Thank you. Thank you, lads.
And we hope to find you on your career podcast. Yes. Yeah. We'll see everybody next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.